Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this podcast episode, local historian David Berge has spent decades researching and writing about the Native people of the Northwest, including the namesake of the city of Seattle. Berge gave a talk recently offering layered details into the life and times of Chief Seattle. Berge spoke with writer and journalist Knut Berger at Folio, the Seattle Athenaeum, on August 3rd. We're presenting our broadcast version here. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum.
Welcome. Thank you for coming. I'm really excited about this because I know Dave is going to be able to teach me a lot that I've been interested in finding out for a long time. Anyway, I remember, I grew up in Seattle, but when I returned to Seattle after college in the mid-1970s, I went down to the Seattle Public Library and asked them if they had a good biography of Chief Seattle. And somewhere along the line, I realized that I didn't know much about Chief Seattle, a person our city is named after. And they gave me a children's book and another book that seemed to have, it didn't meet the kind of scholarly standard I was looking for. It was more of a general tale. And I was really surprised by this, and I began asking friends, you know, historian friends or writer friends about it. Like, why isn't there a book about the guy we named the city after? And it obviously played an important role in the creation of the city. And I was told that it wasn't well documented. There weren't good sources. We don't really know much. And of course, I knew that couldn't possibly be true, but I didn't do anything about it personally. I just kept that as a question. A lot of us think we know Chief Seattle. We see his picture on the logo for the city. We've heard quotes from a speech that he may or may not have given. If you Google Chief Seattle and look under images, you'll see images of other Indian chiefs with big Plains Indian war bonnets, he is still a kind of enigma. And David, of course, has taken the plunge. He's done the thing that historians have put off or ignored or didn't think worthy all these years and has dived in. And so the conversation tonight is just going to be exploring what David has learned and how he learned it. And what does that tell us about the city that we're in, and how did he learn things that should make us look at the city differently? And so, David, I wanted to begin just by kind of asking you to give us a sort of thumbnail sketch of, as you come to know him, a thumbnail sketch of Chief Seattle.
He lived to be probably 80 years old, which is a long life. By the time Americans met up with him, he was an old man. The first historical reference to him, which is made in 1834, and William Fraser told me, writes, he was the handsomest Indian I have ever seen, with a Roman countenance. And he was in his late 40s, early 50s by then. So, of course, he made his bones, as they say, in his earlier decades. It's an odd thing about Seattle is that at some level there's a lot of information that we can know about him, but only by examining the layers of interpretation that's often based on a phrase or a memory, and so you have to plumb that, and you end up asking the question: well, what did the person who wrote this down? What were they trying to say? Why were they saying that? And it's an awful lot like trying to understand what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were talking to in the Synoptic Gospels. You literally have to do that. There are very few remarks that seem to come from Seattle himself. But what they are really striking things. And one of the things that comes to me, and I'll get back to your question, but it's in just before the Battle of Seattle in 1856, Kamiokin, who was a Yakima war leader, apparently sent Ojai, a relative, to Western Washington to gauge temper of Native groups here to see whether or not they would be willing to engage in an uprising against the Americans. It had been long in coming, and they wanted to see just how much support there would be for that. So apparently there was a meeting at the mouth of the Snohomish River at a village called Hybold. There was one over at Port Madison amongst the Snohomish, and there was also one where Pier 70 is, a place called Bakbakwab, which was a little village down there. Apparently at one of these, Seattle said to him, and this is from a native memory, a Skokomish memory, he said, "Leshai, don't kill the men who have married Indian wives. Yesler and those, they have married Indian women. Don't kill them. Take my word. And, you know, you can kill all the rest, but the ones that have married Indian women, don't kill them." Now, there's a whole world of meaning in that, because the purpose that Seattle invited the Americans to come. They just didn't show up and go, "Oh, my God, who are these people?" He actually was down Olympia for 2 years advertising, bringing Americans up to introduce them to his country. And well over a year before the Denny Party landed, three other Americans came and landed on Elliott Bay in the middle of apparently a first salmon ceremony. And this was scripted. Seattle had actually made sure that they would come up. They weren't the first. He actually had a regular tour that he would take people on. These people would come to Olympia, and then he was in there, and he said, "You know, I want you to come up because I've got this place I want you to see." He actually had a spiel. We know because David Maynard wrote it down, but several other people mentioned meeting him there, and he would bring them up. And anyway, they landed at this at Elliott Bay, and he came out and he gave a speech, and he said, "Don't be surprised, all these people yelling and shooting. We don't mean you any harm. This is what we do when we welcome the first salmon in. It's like what we do when the head of the Hudson's Bay Company comes on his visit." And he's talking about George Simpson, who visited Fort Victoria in 1848. And he said, we want you here. We welcome you to our country because we want what you have to offer. We need the things that you produce because we can't produce them ourselves." So it was a sales pitch. And then he had his people take them on a tour all the way into Lake Washington, showed them where the horse trail came over the Cascades down to the shore of the lake, where another spur came and ended up right where they were at Elliott Bay, where Pioneer Square is now. So he was actively involved in this, and actually he had been actively involved in that for years. But he's an old man by then, and out of what does that come? And so the best we can say is that Seattle was born in a period of apocalypse. He was born during the apocalypse, which was around 1770 and 1780, when smallpox was first introduced accidentally on ships from British, maybe Russian, explorers and traders who came here, bringing it from wherever they came from. And because this was a society, the people here had no immunity to it, probably as many as a third were wiped out. It wasn't a decimation of a culture. Decimation means 10% die off. This was much more than that. And it actually started a cascade of death because there were other new diseases that also came in, typhus, diphtheria, measles, that just hit the population one after the other until they were reduced, for example, in the Willamette Valley, by 80 to 90%. They said one of nine people survived in the Willamette Valley. So we cannot imagine what – there is nothing in the Western experience. The Black Death perhaps killed off half the Europeans. That's the closest we can come in our experience to what this was. So it was an absolutely apocalyptic thing, and the interesting thing is, of course, is the Native people survived it. And one of the things I like to point out is, you know, here is a population that has actually been through what we still fear. You know, are we going to wake up one morning and we'll see some angel unzip the sky and, you know, all this crap will come out upon us? We fear that. We fear nuclear annihilation. So we fear the apocalypse. Well, they've lived through it, and they've survived, and they've come back. So they have historical and human knowledge that is exceedingly rare, and we're only now beginning to understand what that means. Well, anyway, so that's where he was born in. We know, for example, his parents, his father, Shwiyab, was said to have been from Suquamish. His mother, Shilatsa, was born on White River. Apparently, he grew up at a little house, not in a little house, it was a village called Stook. In about the time that the smallpox epidemic swept through Puget Sound, there was a great flood on the White River, and completely flooded the valley, as it always did before they built the dams on the Green River. But in any case, it flooded it, and then it was so powerful that it tore out a new channel from the White River that went into the Puyallup. It's called the Stook River Channel today. So the White River actually divided into two distributaries, one going north that met the Green, formed and the White River continued on, and then met the Black, and then formed the Duwamish River that exited into Elliott Bay. That flood apparently produced a huge log jam just west of Auburn. It was a mile long. It lasted years, so long that the silt that collected could give rise to a forest of alder trees and brush that grew on it. When that happened, the combination of literally the land being changed and the impact of the smallpox epidemic decimated apparently a village called Flea's House. And then with that, five noble Duwamish families literally pull up their house posts and they move south to the southern end of the log jam, and they build their houses. These are noble families, and they suddenly become this presence, and they lord it over everybody. And the people of Flea's House, who apparently at one time had nobility, but they were decimated by the epidemic, and as people said, they were treated like slaves by the Stokobch, the people of the Stook village, Stokobch, the people of Stook. Well, there's an amazing amount of, information from informants that were given at the turn of the century to two Western ethnographers, T.T. Waterman, Thomas Talbot Waterman, and John P. Harrington. And these were, they interviewed several people, and they have lots of things to say about these two villages, and especially about Seattle's ancestry. Apparently, both Seattle's mother and father came from Flea's House. And they not only that, they were cousins. They married, it was an endogamous marriage. A noble marriage was always, you always married outside your group because you wanted to extend the group's economic ties. Sometimes it was not uncommon for people within it, if it was a large longhouse, to marry. But almost everybody there was related anyway, so that just would not have been done. But it seems to have been the case for Seattle's father and mother. But his father was also considered a noble at Suquamish. So he apparently had some history at Flea's House before the plague, when it was a noble village. But then he and Shilatsa, his wife, had a history after that as well. Now, Shwiyab remained at Suquamish, and Shilatsa was buried in the White River. Well, Seattle was supposedly have been born, may have been in Flea's House, but he was raised in Stook. He was a young man that was raised in Stook. And he had this taint of slavery. It possibly may be because of the ambivalence regarding his parentage, but actually what it turns out was that Shwiyab's grandmother apparently was captured by some northern group and hauled off into slavery, but she was rescued and brought back, but still she was a slave. So that taint stayed with her. And it was apparently a paternal grandmother because both Seattle and Curly, who lived down here, was Seattle's half-brother, and the grandmother was apparently on the father's side. Well, I mean, this is really very involved. And so that is why, and then even in the 1850s, an American Indian agent, E.E.A. Starling, said, well, you know, if it weren't for his good sense, Seattle would really have trouble with this because they say his mother's a slave. So in 1854, this story was float. As a matter of fact, it was being given currency because the Americans had just made Seattle the head chief of not just the Duwamish, but the Suquamish. Now, Angeline said actually her father was the chief of the Duwamish, not the Suquamish, but by the 1850s, he had developed such a reputation that the Suquamish, with whom he was related, thanks to his father and other relatives, made him their head chief as well. In any case, the interesting thing about the story is it survived until the 1950s in a strange way, and there was a, I can't remember his name, he was a Skokomish legislator. He was a member of the Skokomish tribe, and he was a legislator in George Adams, and he was a legislator in Washington, in Olympia. And he was sort of to the right of Attila the Hun, but nevertheless he was a well-known, really interesting, colorful person. But he said, "Yeah, Seattle, you know, everybody raves about it. The white men rave about it, but the Indians know better. For heaven's sake, he was born a slave in Fleeburg. The name Fleeburg was actually a name given to a village on Lake Washington." It was an historic assemblage of people. But Fleeburg, Flea's House, the memory of a slave. So until the 1950s, that was still grist for the argument. So he had a very ambivalent past. That's how he starts his life, in a culture that is in collapse. Now, the result of all this change, the terrible destruction caused by the epidemics, but also the introduction of firearms from the Hudson's Bay Company and the Nor'westers. Slave raiding, which had probably gone on, and especially when populations are reduced by half or a third, what do? Well, you go on slaving expeditions to kill the men so they can't come back, and to capture the women and the children so you can bring them back so you can rebuild your populations. And so that was the impetus for the slave raids. And that happened. And so all of this was taking place in Puget Sound when Seattle was born. He was still a small boy, probably not into his double digits yet, when a raid from somewhere, we don't know, wiped out the people on Salmon Bay, the Shoshalopsh. Angeline said he was a little boy when that happened. Now, that raid set in motion an effort by a very prominent Suquamish chief, Kitsap, to plan retribution, to attack the people who caused the raids. And in the 1820s, that would have been the Cowichans from western Vancouver Island, to create a confederation of tribes, groups in Puget Sound that would then go north in an armada of canoes, attack the village, and just cause enough havoc that would prevent the Cowichan from keeping raiding. There are several stories about even before that happening, when Seattle was in his 20s, there was a group coming down the White River. These were people who were from the interior, who usually wintered over in the upper headwaters of the Green and White River. And these were Tobshada, these were Yakima. The name for them here was Tobshada, which meant trader, but it also meant warrior. So think of like the Vikings. To go a Viking, what did you do? Well, you know, you killed a lot of people and you stole a lot of stuff and you went back and you were wealthy. So Tobshadad were slavers, but they were also traders. And because they were mobile, they came on horses, things like deer with out antlers on their heads, whatever they were. They're wonderful, great, but we'll get to those. Anyway, so they came, and so what was the reaction of the people? We got to marry these people. We got to get them in. First of all, if you intermarry with them, the violence would be mitigated. And this is how they dealt with a lot of their conflicts here was there was a sexual politics. You know, okay, look, you know, we agree to disagree. Why don't you marry my daughter? And we can talk about that. You know, and so they would. So, for example, the Suquamish intermarried with the Cowichan after the Great Raid. And these things happened. Well, this is what the local people did when people invaded. This was a remarkable lesson. It was just made common sense, and it was the traditional approach. And, of course, Seattle tried to use this with the Americans, at first with tremendous success. With the rustics, the workers that came in, most of them single. But then when the educated middle-class Americans came in, oh, we can't have that because that was racial suicide. And so that didn't work.
Can you get back to his personality?
Yes. Okay. So he comes to this is his life, you know. This is what he comes from. And so he gains fame as a war leader. He is a war leader. First on the White River, and then he joins with Kitsap in this enormous effort to hammer the Cowichans. It is a Pyrrhic victory. Most of the native people are killed, but nevertheless, the Cowichan have it enough, and so they intermarry. So that's his background. And then in the 1840s, oh, I should say, one of the artifacts of Kitsap's alliance is Old Man House, this enormous wooden structure, probably the largest ever built on Puget Sound. And remember, now there probably were larger ones built in the 1870s and 80s, but they were done from sawn lumber from sawmills, and they were using hammers and nails and saws. In the 1810s and 20s, they were done carved with stone tools. There's a tremendous amount of labor. So that huge building was like the cornerstone of this effort. And it was a symbol to the people of what they could do when they were organized. Well, anyway, so in the 1840s, Seattle apparently fortifies part of that because there are stories of him raiding up on the Snoqualmie River. As a matter of fact, there's a great story of him. He's being chased by Yakima, and he's in his canoe, and he comes down the Snoqualmie River, and he's on the brink of the falls, and he jumps off onto a rock, which was called Seattle Rock. It was right at the brink of Snoqualmie Falls. And, of course, the Yakima, they go over the falls. And, you know, it's a great story. Now, the interesting thing is, it's like this can't possibly – they don't say how he got off the rock. And what could they do? Well, they could take trees and lower them with ropes, you know. No. But there are stories, for example, there's a Tawana story about Yakima coming down in canoes unfamiliarly because they're from eastern Washington, and they end up going over the falls in a canoe, which is very believable. And there's a story about a Suquamish woman, Mary Sam, whose mother was captured on the Upper Snoqualmie by a Suquamish headman. So the Suquamish are raiding on the Upper Snoqualmie, and Seattle is there. It's mentioned as being present there. He and Curly take revenge on a White River village about 1841, kill a lot of people, capture a lot of slaves. So he is a violent person. And when the Hudson's Bay Company comes in, no other native leader has as many negative epithets associated with him in the Hudson's Bay writing as Seattle. It's the most amazing thing. Well, the blackguard, a villain, he's a scamp, he's just up to no good, you know. And they talk about him getting into fights with people, threatening them with guns. And then at one point, the Hudson's Bay Company is trying to maintain peace because that's the only way the trade is going to develop. So what does Seattle do? Well, he kills a shaman with a gun gotten from the Sahiwamish around Olympia, and his people want him dead. And so there's huge hubbub, and so the Hudson's Bay Company finally prevails on another Suquamish. His name is Stilicum, and this is Seattle's predecessor, and Stilicum is a very fascinating figure. But he's more of a peacemaker, and he's very clever. And so they get Stilicum, and he said, well, we'll go up and we'll arrange a peace. We'll have a sham battle. There's a lot of shooting and yelling. Nobody gets hurt. And then we pay. So Seattle has to pay the Sahiwamish because he bought the gun from them that he killed this shaman with. His family has to pay the shaman's family. And supposedly it's all taken care of. But whoever is writing the Journal of Occurrence at Nisqually House says, I wish they would just determine on shooting the villain. So that's the Hudson's Bay Company's version of Seattle. He and his followers, all armed, show up to trade, and they finally leave. And the writer says, you know, thank God they've all gone. At one point, William Fraser told me when they leave, on another occasion, he turns to the writings of St. Paul for solace. So they obviously have a lot of trouble with this guy. And there's a case to be made, actually, that the raiding that Seattle carried out so disturbed the life in central Puget Sound that the fur trade basically petered out. Now, there was, of course, the whole thing about the change of styles, that the beaver hat disappeared, but they weren't just trading in beaver. They were trading in ermine and marten and everything else. And so finally, the Hudson's Bay Company just threw up its arms and said, okay, we've got this big prairie. Let's just plant it in wheat, raise cattle and horses, and we'll create the Puget Sound Agricultural Company. And we'll get some colonists in here to take care of it. the Hudson's Bay Company would have never gotten colonists in, because the point was just to have a relationship with the Indians, the traditional Indians. Seattle was one of the people that made that so difficult that the Hudson's Bay Company had to change its tactics.
So that's really interesting, because you know, you're suggesting that Seattle has had this seminal role in the colonization of the area.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then he's kind of like a Native American C.D. Hillman, right? The real estate developer in Seattle who put on cruises and took people out to the Platts and told them it was the New Eden.
So how do we get from war leader to that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, laggard to real estate salesman.
So, and there's, if you read like Eva Greenslade Anderson's biography of Seattle or John Metcalf's, and they always have, when Blanchette and Demers, these two Catholic missionaries first show up, well, they're not missionaries, they're priests, and they're sent in to basically serve the engagés, the workers of the Hudson's Bay Company who were retired and living here, but also their native wives. Anyway, they show up, and interestingly, the native people show great interest in this. Steilacoom is one of the leaders of this. But in these stories, Seattle is always there. It's a lot of his name was Felix Verwilgen. He was a priest who confused Seattle with Steilacoom, said they were one and the same people. Steilacoom went out of his way to get priests to come up to Whidbey Island. And there were a lot of reasons why he did this. But anyway, if you think he's Seattle, then obviously in the late 1830s and 1840s, here's Seattle bringing the priests in. So he's obviously a religious leader. Well, that wasn't Seattle at all. We'll get to how I know that it wasn't Seattle. But anyway, he was a war leader. But there were other people who remembered Kitsap, its alliance. And when the British and the Americans, when war began to break out in the 1830s and 40s, the Cayuse War, then the question was, well, what's going to happen to us? What on earth is happening? Because these people show up and they say, oh, by the way, the land belongs to us now. It's like, well, how could this possibly be? And as I mentioned in the book, you know, the Oregon country was the last temperate region of North America to be captured by the nets of imperialism. And there was obviously a real competition between the United States and Great Britain, who was going to control this. In any case, one of the people who tried to reduplicate Kitsap's effort was Patkanum, a Snoqualmie leader. And probably around 1847-48, two Americans go to Whidbey Island, Glasgow and Rabison. And they had been settling in the Olympia area, also around Toledo. And this is in the middle of a Cayuse War. And so what? You know, that's in the east of the mountains. The people here aren't warlike. And so they row themselves. They don't hire an Indian crew, so they're apparently a little, and they go by way of Hood Canal, which avoids most of the sound. And they end up on Whidbey, and of all things, Glasgow marries the daughter of Patkanum. It's like, so Patkanum obviously wants some tie. But then they, both Rabison and Glasgow, witnessed what they say was a huge gathering of thousands of people. And there's a big debate about, well, what are we going to do with these Americans, these Hudson's Bay companies and Americans? And a fellow named, Patkanum says, you know, we've got to get rid of them because they're going to take us all in ships and take us to a place called Polaki Ilahi, the land of darkness, and they're going to capture our land. And John Taylor, who's from the village of Steilacoom, says, yes, I've been to their settlements. They're as thick as fleas, and they don't, you know, nothing good can come from these people. And then a man, his name was Snohodomta, he was prematurely gray, he gets up and he says, well, you know, before the Americans came, I've had trouble with the Snoqualmie always coming down and raiding us. Now that the Americans are there, I don't have this problem anymore. So why do you want to get rid of them? And then the Duwamish chief, he's identified as a Duwamish chief, stands up and he says, you know, for those people that are troubled by raids going south, I and my people will stand and protect you. And Snoho Dumpta said, I'd rather have one American with a rifle than all of the Duwamish. And so the place just collapses in divisiveness. And then there's a threat that the Patkanium is going to kill Glasgow and Rabison, but blame Snoho Dumpta so that the Americans will attack his village. And so these two guys leave. And they come back to Olympia with these stories. We just narrowly avoided death, and the Indians are planning to wipe us out. Well, actually, something was going on, because there were all sorts of warnings given to Hudson's Bay Company personnel around that time. Snoqualmie said they'd come down, they'd have the head of a man named Joseph Heath, who had a farm down there. Whidbey Island Skagit man, Sneedlem, attacks an embassy sent north of Vancouver, or Fort Langley. This had never happened before. So something was happening. Well, in May 1st, and I think it's 1849, Pat Canham and a bunch of armed Snoqualmies come down to Fort Nisqually, and Hudson's Bay Company are saying, you know, you're threatening us, you're all armed, what is this? And they said, well, we're just having trouble with Lahalut, who is a Nisqually Indian, because he's mistreating his wife. And so Pat Canham goes into the fort to and gifts are given to the armed men, and then somebody in the fort is cleaning his rifle, and he shoots. And all of a sudden, the Snoqualmie, of course, they've got Pat Canham. They've killed him. So they charge the fort, and a big shootout occurs, and two Americans are killed. Well, now it's gone to blood. This is, of course, after the Cayuse War, but this is in western Washington. So Oregon territory, well, Oregon has just gained territorial status. And so the American Indian agent, Thornton, sends a message to the new governor, Lane, you know, we've had this attack, there's these Americans killed. So they rush troops into the Puget Sound region, and they threaten to wipe out the Indians unless they surrender the people that were involved in the killing of the two Americans. Of course, several Indians were killed too, but they didn't count. So in any case, they surrendered. And so they said, we will give 80 blankets for the people who are guilty, or if it waits too long, we'll double the amount. So who shows up with them but Pat Canham? They're his brothers. And he surrenders them, and he gets 80 blankets, he and the other Snoqualmie chiefs. And Thornton is just amazed. Why did you do that? This is a stupid thing to do. You're giving blankets to the people who arranged this attack on Fort Nisqually, but this is a typical American bureaucratic snafu. Well, anyway, they hold the court proceeding. They trot out these Snoqualmie. They have defense attorneys appointed to represent them. The prosecution, within, they have a trial. They have a grand jury first, and then they indict these guys, and then they go to trial, and three are found guilty, and they are hung. And the whole Snoqualmie tribe is required to be present to see this is what American justice does. And apparently there was a great number of other people, too, and apparently Seattle was among them. So this, it seems to me, this beginning where Seattle is thinking, okay, now wait a minute. You know, if these people are going to do all this because two of them got killed, we need to really think what we're going to do here. We have to really examine this, because he's actually probably one of the chiefs that Thornton and the other officials invite to Fort Nisqually and they ask him, you know, so how is authority distributed amongst your people? And they give these chiefs blankets, and Seattle is probably one of them. These are never named. These chiefs are never named. But by this time, he is already a significant person, a frightening person. By 18, we'll get to that in a minute. But anyway, so this trial happens, and it's kind of a turning point for Seattle. And so, you know, if you can't lick them, join them. Pat Canham will come to the same conclusion. Chetsamoka at Port Townsend will do the same thing. We have to find some way to deal with these people, and one of the ways is intermarry with them. Marry into their society. Shortly after that, I'm not quite sure if I've got this correct, Seattle is involved in a genocidal war against the Chemicum. of where Port Townsend is now. And there's all this back and forth. A shaman is killed, not the one that Seattle killed, but a shaman is killed. And they blame, it's a Clallam person that kills a shaman, but the Clallam don't want to be blamed. And so they convince Seattle. They said, look, the daughter of one of our chief will marry your son, Chakwal. And Chakwal is a warrior. And he is described as having a power which is described as driftwood eaten out by worms, which is an amazing image. It's like a heart voided of compassion or mercy during battle. Now, it's like, so you get these extraordinary bits of information about these people in the midst of a vast desert without any more data. So you have to figure out, well, what in the world? Anyway, so they decided, now the Chemicum, that is a long history I don't want to get into, but they are not sailor-speaking people. No one actually knows, you know, what they're related. They're probably related to the Quinault linguistically. But anyway, they're surrounded by enemies, and they've been reduced. And so the Clallam and the Suquamish decide to wipe them out. And so they do. They arrange this attack at night. They surround the surviving Chemicum village. This is around 1845. And at dawn, the person who shot the shaman goes out, probably to take a leak. He's shot down. The people wake up, and as they come pouring out of the village, the warriors around just fire into them, and they wipe them out, slaughter them. And there's a great story about previous to this, when the shaman was killed, his relatives dug out the lead slug that had passed through him and gone into the wall, and they hammered it back into shape and vowed to return it to the person who shot him. And so when at the end of this massacre of the Chemicum, Seattle's son is leading it. Seattle's there too, and he's shot with the same bullet, they say. And as he goes to the ground, Seattle cries out, "Oh, my son, he is down. He is down." Again, we have these quotes. These are not created by white people or historians. These are what the native people remembered. And again, you have this extraordinary moment full of detail and drama in it's the oasis in the desert of unknowing. Well, anyway, so that seals his reputation. Seattle is one frightening person. And yet he makes this change after the trial of Pat Canham, and he decides he's nothing if not single-minded. And that, okay, the Americans, because the British are already leaving. The Treaty of Washington has already divided, partitioned Oregon, so the Americans get south of 49, the British get north. So they're already separating, and the Indians, of course, are aware of this. And so the Americans are in charge, and the Americans mean business. They've already been involved in one fight, the Cayuse War, and now they've arranged this really spectacular show trial in which they've hung these people and threatened to exterminate everybody else if they cause trouble. So what are you going to do? So then Seattle moves down to Olympia, and he sets up shop at a place called Chinook Street. And, you know, it's like, well, how am I going to find out about Chinook Street? So I've got two or three sources that talk about it. So then I write down, well, you write to the Thurston County Historical Society, and they go, oh, yeah, Chinook Street. You know, we've heard about this. We have these bits of information. So you pull it all together, and it's not just Seattle, but he's there, and it's described in an 1860 diary. Seattle and his Duwamish are down in Chinook Street, and this is a guy that expects to be noticed, and he'll give you a shake of the hand, and with a grunt knows that he knows that you're there. And why he's there is he's basically getting people to go on these tours to his homeland, and he wants to get Americans into trade, because if they'll trade, like the Hudson's Bay, he and his people will become wealthy and better. If he intermarries with them, then you've got this hybrid society, which basically should solve a lot of the problems that these two contending societies face.
So this is where the Denny Party.
Oh, we're not even there yet. Oh no. We got a long way to go. So these people start showing up. Luther Collins. He gets taken on a tour Holgate, Milton, one of the Holgates. And he's taken up, and he takes them, the people associated with Seattle take him to this village that's located where Boeing Fields is today. And they're known as the Proud People or the Confident People. And he loves it. And he describes in detail the planks that they have. They're 50 or 60 feet long. They're 2.5 feet wide, 2 inches thick. Beautiful workmanship. He's very impressed with this. And he stakes his claim, but he doesn't know that the donation land law, which Congress had just passed, required that you were supposed to write down where this was with the officials. So he goes back to get married in Ohio. In the meantime, Luther Collins comes up. He's taken on a tour of the Duwamish River, but there's just too many Indians. So he goes back down to the Nisqually, where there are more Americans. Some other people show up, Van Asselt, the Maples. And he said, well, why don't you live with me in the Nisqually? And they're not too pleased with the land available. They said, well, okay, I know of another place that's pretty good. And if you don't mind living with a lot of Indians, you might like that. So he takes them up to the Duwamish, and they like it. And so they settle there in 1850. Seattle has another group. Now he actually has people living there. And according to a memory, he's there waving as they bring their gear around Duwamish head. Then back in Olympia, he meets Charles Fay. Now this is the figure. This is the figure that really brings about settlement in Elliott Bay. And Charles Fay is a mercantile entrepreneur. He's headquartered in San Francisco at the corner of California and Pine. He has an office there. And they basically find stuff to sell. And then they'll offer it to groups who buy it, and then they'll make a certain cut of the profit. And so Fay had been sailing around the Pacific. He was a whaler, and he had been on Puget Sound before. And so he conceives the idea, if I barrel salmon, if I catch salmon and barrel them and bring them to California. When I was a Peace Corps volunteer and I asked an Indian, I was in Nepal, and I asked an Indian agricultural officer, well, what can we grow here that Nepalese can export to India? And he goes, they'll eat any damn thing you give them. It was kind of like that. You know, anything you sell to San Francisco, they'll eat any damn thing you give them. And so this has got to really work. And so Fay gets a Swedish carpenter, Charles Martin, and they set up shop with Seattle. Seattle invites them up. And they set up shop at this village at Duwamish Head. Seattle has 700 native people. Thomas Prosh gives us the number, the historian Thomas Prosh. And they're catching all these salmon, bringing them in. They're brining them in the barrels, and then they tap the bungs in, and then they take them down to Olympia, and they transship them from there down to San Francisco. So this is a really remarkable thing. So this is the first industry on Elliott Bay. Fay is down to in Olympia getting a shipment ready to go to San Francisco. Who shows up? David Denny, Charlie Terry. And he said, and so that we're looking for a place to settle. Oh, I've just got the place for you because I've got this Indian chief and he wants Americans there. Come with me. And so he brings David Denny and Charles Terry north, and they go with him. And sure enough, there's Seattle. And the thing is just going great guns. And so they show him. They said, this is fantastic. And so David Denny scribbles the fateful note. Have visited the Duwamish River. It's great. Room enough for 1,000 people. Come at once. Now, this is one of those, like the Zimmerman telegram. I mean, this is a fateful message. Because what it is, it's the death knell of Native culture in the Elliott Bay in Puget Sound, but it's also the realization of Seattle's dream. In 1850, while all this is happening, three other men show up in Olympia, Isaac Eby, Benjamin Franklin Shaw, and a man named Lindsay, and they get in a longboat and they sail up. They're invited to sail up north to Elliott Bay, and they land when a first salmon ceremony is in session. Hundreds of people celebrating, and they were shooting rifles in the air. So this is an electrifying welcome. The people rush down to the shore. They pull up the longboat onto the beach, and who shows up? Seattle steps out, stands on a log, and he says, don't be afraid. This is the kind of greeting we normally give to the first salmon of the season, and also to the governor of the Hudson's Bay Company when he comes, and he's referring to a visit that George Simpson made in Fort Victoria a few years before. And we're glad to welcome you here because we need everything you can make. This is Seattle, talking to Benjamin Franklin Saw and Isaac Eby. We need everything you can make because we don't know how to make it. But we want to trade with you. We want you here. And, oh, by the way, why is it you find you just come, you trust yourself to come amongst us in so few numbers? Now, this is probably a set piece because later, 50 years later, this appears in print. And I believe it's Shaw who writes, and then I gave a speech saying, we come from the land of the sunrise. We are, you know, there are millions of us, blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. But anyway, and then they attend a apparently a secret society initiation. So this is, Seattle is trying to demonstrate to him his people's life and invite them in. Now, do we know that Seattle said that? Well, probably he did. First of all, it's unlike anything ever written by anybody else where they have, like Henry Smith's speech, where it's filled with his orotund purple prose. This is very direct. It just sounds like what a native person would say. But also, there's all these other people going up. So it fits with all this other stuff that's happening. So he takes them on a tour. They see Lake Washington. They see the White River, the trail going over the passes that ends on Lake Washington. And they write a big description of it that appears in the Oregon Spectator. So all this advertising is bringing all these people in. So in November, the Denny Party shows up. Now, that's when everything gets complicated, if it's not complicated enough already. Because the donation land law has basically said to the Americans, well, you know, we'll offer you 320 acres for a man, 320 acres for a woman, free. All you got to do is live on it for 4 or 5 years, improve it, mean build a house and stay there. But the Americans don't have title to the land. They have never had a treaty with the Indians to relinquish title to the land. So they've got to do that, but they're busy offering the Indians land to these new American settlers who come in initially as pioneers. They're coming in hopefully to make a life in the Northwest. But now they're coming in to get what's theirs. The government has already given them this land. All they got to do now is get in there and claim it. A totally different attitude. When they come, of course, when the Denny Party comes, they start laying out claims. Well, while this is going on, other Indians get involved. For example, a chief of the Duwamish, his name is Question, he comes down the river to Arthur Denny, who is the Tyee of the Americans, and he asks him to give his sons Boston names. He has three sons. One is named William, one is named Tecumseh, one is named Keokuk. These are the names that Arthur Denny gave him. So naming, of course, is a very important custom, and that he was asking Arthur Denny to give us Boston names so we can get along better with one another. Shortly after this, Henry Yesler, I'm getting ahead of myself. Fay has another bunch of barrels that go down to Olympia of salmon. So he goes down there, and the first shipment hasn't turned out well. They've all rotted. And so he accompanies this second shipment down there, and he basically leaves. So Seattle's left holding the bag. So Seattle goes down to Olympia. He's at Duwamish Head, but he goes down to Olympia to get a person to replace Fay. And who does he find? David Maynard. And so he says to David Maynard, okay, look, I've got this place. You're going to love it. There's hunting, fishing there. There's lots of Indian labor. I can provide you with whatever labor you want. They will make you rich. So this is his spiel.
That's it for this podcast of Speakers Forum. Again, you can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Tune in again soon.